This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Officials in North Topsail Beach called a special meeting last week to address the loss of 900 feet of dunes. It's thought that winter storms and two hurricanes are the cause of erosion, but there may be another contributor. A team of researchers at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's Institute of Marine Sciences recently published results of a multi-year study conducted in Onslow County that found sea level anomalies, or periods of higher than normal water levels, can cause extensive erosion. This week, I spoke with PhD student Ethan Tierkoff about the study and the impact sea level anomalies have on our beaches.
They last anywhere from a couple weeks up to over a month. They're initiated by meteorological events, so like persistent northeasterly winds, or by changes in ocean currents. So, for instance, a reduction in speed of the Gulf Stream.
How do sea level anomalies differ from other causes of coastline erosion?
They operate on different timescales than like storms and long-term sea level rise. You know, storms, they operate on hours to days, and they create a storm surge, and that erodes the beach. And then long-term sea level rise is years to decades to centuries. So these sea level anomalies are impacting the beach in these kind of interim, week-to-month-long periods.
Now, how often do sea level anomalies occur?
So we may have one to two anomalies each year, but what's really important is when we have these periods of frequent and kind of higher magnitude anomalies. And those occur every few years. So we recognized a period in 2009 and 2010 where we had frequent sea level anomalies. But when we looked back at the water level record for Wrightsville Beach, there was actually another period from 2004 to 2005 where there were frequent sea level anomalies. We may have one or two every year, but that's not really that impactful because it's really when you have these frequent anomalies when you have the higher erosion.
Now, you've been doing some research on sea level spikes and how they compare with erosion from hurricanes. How long did the study last, and what were some of your findings?
We worked on this from 2009 to 2012, and we worked down at Onslow Beach, a barrier island located at Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune. And it's a really neat barrier island to look at coastal geology, and in particular, because along its length, it has really variable topography. Like in the southern end of the island, we have low elevation dunes. We have narrow beaches, and we have the beach shoreline is eroding relatively rapidly. But then in the northern end, we have higher dunes, wider beach, the shoreline is more stable. And so we can look at how many different types of barrier islands are affected by sea level anomalies and storms. And so what we did was we collected beach erosion data, we collected wave height data, and water level data. We also combined that with NOAA tide gauge data. And what we found was that from 2009 to 2010, about 40% of the water level observations were sea level anomalies. So we had frequent sea level anomalies, but we didn't have any big storms. However, from 2011 to 2012, we had Hurricane Irene come through. And what we found from the beach erosion data was that we had similar amounts of erosion during the year with sea level anomalies as we did the year after Hurricane Irene impacted the North Carolina coast.
Interesting. So years where there are frequent sea level anomalies, there can be just as much erosion as a hurricane.
Yeah, and actually in some spots along Onslow Beach, we had higher erosion in the year with sea level anomalies as we did after Hurricane Irene.
Is there anything that can be done to slow the progression and impact of sea level anomalies?
Probably the best way to deal with sea level anomalies is to include them in coastal planning and management. Right now, these management plans and these models are really just thinking about storms and sea level rise. But we also have these periods of higher than normal water level, these sea level anomalies, that can erode the beach. And I think these really need to start being incorporated into management plans because they can increase the vulnerability of beaches to storms.
Our proximity to the Gulf Stream is what makes North Carolina's coast more susceptible to coastal erosion in the form of sea level anomalies. Now, do you predict there's going to be an increase or a decrease in the number of anomalies in the coming years?
Moving forward with climate change, we might actually, as the Gulf Stream slows down and we have changes in weather patterns, we might actually see more frequent sea level anomalies and higher magnitude anomalies. And so that's going to add to the effects we see of more intense storms or accelerated sea level rise.
Ethan Tierkoff is a PhD student at the Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Jared. It was my pleasure.
Jazz is a true American art form, from ragtime of the 1920s to the swinging sounds of the big band era to present day. It's syncopated rhythms and improvisation, music that elicits motion and energy. If you enjoy jazz, you may already have your tickets for Saturday's Where Rivers Meet Summer Jazz Festival. Public Radio East is a media sponsor. The featured headliner is Gregory Porter. He's the winner of a Grammy Award for Best Jazz Vocal Album for his 2013 Liquid Spirit.
Unreroute the rivers, let the damned water feed. There's some people down the way that's thirsty. Let the liquid spirit free.
The festival at New Bern's Tryon Palace will also feature jazz innovators Elevation and noted pianist and composer Helen Sung.
There has not been an outdoor jazz festival in this area, New Bern, that anyone can remember, and especially at Tryon Palace. It's the first time that this has ever been done.
Larry Turner is the president and founder of the East Coast Jazz Review, a nonprofit focused on cultivating jazz education and appreciation through performances. He says he was inspired to bring world-class musicians that usually perform at major jazz festivals to Eastern North Carolina.
We wanted to be able to have something that wouldn't require people who love the music to have to leave their area to be able to enjoy this, and then to bring other people here as well to make New Bern a destination for a great jazz festival.
The Where Rivers Meet concert is a ticketed event and will take place this Saturday on Tryon Palace's South Lawn. Gates open at 5 p.m. The music starts at 6.
Be good is a name. I trim my lion's claws and I cut my mane, and I would if I could.
It is an honor to have Gregory Porter, a headliner of that magnitude. It's beyond rare. It's out there in the stars. It's almost extraterrestrial, because it doesn't happen.
Last week, Porter returned from a European tour, and this past week he's been tied up in the recording studio. We did connect with Helen Sung, who is emerging on the jazz scene as a composer. Today, Mac McKee talks with her about making the transition from performing classical music to jazz and her upcoming performance at Tryon Palace.
Helen, I understand you started your musical life as a classically trained pianist. When did you first hear jazz and know that was the direction you wanted to take?
I was studying, doing my undergraduate degree in classical piano performance at the University of Texas at Austin. I thought I would be going to a big fancy conservatory, but life didn't work out that way. In retrospect, I'm glad it didn't, because I'm pretty sure I would still be just doing classical today. So I was almost done with my undergrad, and a fellow pianist invited me to go hear Harry Connick Jr., and I was your typical classical pianist. I spent most of my life in the practice room and didn't really know much of what was going on, on the pop scene or stuff like that. And she reassured me, said, "Don't worry, he's really cute. You'll like him." So we went to hear him at the concert hall in town. in the middle of the concert, he sat down and played some solo piano pieces. And I remember just being thunderstruck, like thinking, how come no one told me about this before? And I immediately enrolled in an intro to jazz piano class at UT. And, you know, in retrospect, I think things tend to sound neat and organized. And it wasn't like all of a sudden I said, oh my gosh, I'm going to be a jazz pianist. I still did my classical stuff, but I started making jazz an important part of my life, you know, because I really didn't know much about it. And I went to the library at UT and listened to whatever I could get my hands on. I begged the UT piano professor for lessons. I participated in combos and whatever jazz courses were offered.
Well, apart from Harry Connick Jr., Helen, who are some of your musical idols?
Well, probably my favorite composer and just musician is the great Wayne Shorter. I had the amazing blessing to play with his band back in the year 2000. I just think he's so creative, so personal and unique. Of course, his colleague, Herbie Hancock, McCoy Tyner, Thelonious Monk. I'm really inspired by the band Weather Report. We were speaking about that a little bit earlier, just how creative and forward-looking they were.
Did your classical training make the transition to jazz easier, and what are the similarities or differences in the musical styles?
Well, I would say yes and no. I think what classical music gave me, and I do recommend that all artists, aspiring musicians, pianists, take study classical music, because it gave me a good technique, a good healthy physical approach to the keyboard, because, you know, you don't want to injure yourself. And then no, because, you know, classical music is all about interpreting the notes on the page and doing it perfectly. And jazz, you know, at least at the outset, it's improvisation, which, you know, was like, how, it was like a magic to me. It was like, how do they do that? And, you know, it's often said that jazz is a language, but it really is true. You know, I had to learn a whole new language, a musical language, and that was something I worked so hard on. It was a total paradigm shift and something I will always be working on. And I'm just so grateful that I was able to find a place in jazz music.
Now, jazz has been described as America's contribution to classical music, Helen. Did you find that as a new generation of jazz fans and as a performer that you're eager to perform new trends in jazz and that new jazz fans are eager to hear them?
I do think it's so true. You know, it came from the African-American community, and it's just influenced all popular music in America, and jazz is really a global music today, I think. You know, one thing I appreciate so much about jazz is I always call it one of the most generous art forms, because it has influenced so many different genres of music. It can assimilate so many different kinds of treatments and yet retain its core, which I think is very unique and is what makes jazz something timeless. You know, it'll always be here, always be relevant, always be close to the heart of just creativity, you know, human expression.
Helen, what is the difference in musical energy between a studio performance for you and a live performance?
Oh, that's a good question. For me, it's harder to play in the studio because there's this pressure, you know, that I feel like every time, the more I record, the better I get at handling it. But there's this pressure of, oh my gosh, this is being recorded. And if I made a mistake, it's going to be on tape. And it's like, and there's this, you know, I wouldn't say artificial aspect, but the fact is you're documenting this. So it's a very structured environment. You're in an isolation booth, you know, most of the time. You have headphones on. You can't really hear the piano. They have the piano all wrapped up, and you hear your band through headphones. I would say what we are trying to duplicate in the studio is the excitement, the unknownness, the spontaneity of a live performance, because, you know, when you're playing four people and they're there right in front of you, there's a special communication and exchange of energy that, you know, you can't really duplicate, because you need people there. And their energy, the excitement, appreciation in turn fuels the band and inspires us to play more and better and reaching higher things artistically. But I love both, and each has its challenges for sure.
Now, in your travels around the country, when you play in different areas, do you find that each region of the United States has its own different jazz feel, its different approach and response to it when you perform?
It's interesting. I think the regional differences really used to be pronounced. You know, you talk about New Orleans, the Kansas City sound, Chicago, Detroit, New York. But I think actually it's becoming less so because of how connected our society is and how jazz has been really, just at least the teaching of jazz has been moved into the university setting, whereas before, you know, there wasn't the internet that kept you instantaneously connected all the time, you know, that people really lived within their communities. And I think that's why music really had distinctive flavors in different parts of the country and the world. So, you know, I think things are in flux right now, so it's hard for me to say because I think any time something gets moved into an institution, it gets streamlined in some ways. But I think jazz is such a powerful music. I'm interested in seeing what's going to happen like 5 to 10 years from now.
On August 23rd, you'll be appearing at the Public Radio East Media-sponsored event. It's called Where Rivers Meets on the South Lawn at New Bern's Tryon Palace. Now, here's a question before you. Have you performed in North Carolina before? And if you have, where? And if not, I guess what took you so long? We'll be glad to have you.
Well, you know, I've never performed there as a leader. I've performed in Charlotte and Raleigh-Durham and Asheville. But it's been a while, and I'm a huge fan of North Carolina, so I'm so happy to be back and so excited to be a part of, you know, East Coast Jazz Review's festival, where Rivers Meet at the Tryon Palace, and I'm looking forward to being a part of it. So, yeah.
In addition to the Helen Sung Quintet and Gregory Porter, the innovative band Elevations performs at the Where Rivers Meet Festival. Winner of the 2012 Monterey Jazz Festival Next Generation Jazz Artist Award, this Pittsburgh native group is composed of young adults performing around the world. Legendary jazz drummer Roger Humphreys played an instrumental part in forming Elevations.
I think a lot of they're on the same path of like when Whit Marsalis and all the other young players started playing. They're on the same pathway. They're fine, good young musicians individually.
Humphreys began teaching many of the members of Elevations in high school.
They are some fantastic kids, and I'm glad to be part of their lives growing up with them.
The five-member group combines different styles of music, incorporating hip-hop, R&B, funk, classical, rock, and pop into their repertoire.
Sometimes they be playing some tunes with the Latin feeling, where the drummer and the bass player and keyboard playing, they be Latin feeling. And then sometimes they just playing some nice, happy, what you call contemporary songs. You can hear the flavor of their youthfulness. I don't know how to really describe it, except it's some good music.
The Where Rivers Meet concert is a ticketed event and takes place Saturday on Tryon Palace's South Lawn. Gates open at 5 p.m. The music starts at 6. If you'd like more information on this event, go to our website, publicradioeast.org.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. We have a wonderful native fruit ripening right now all around eastern North Carolina. It comes in different colors, bronze, red, black. All are delicious with a very intense fruity taste. They make great jellies and jams. Some people even use them to make wine. You know what I'm talking about. It's muscadine grape time. There are small wild muscadines growing everywhere around my house and the island where I live, and maybe around your house too. And they can be quite tasty, but the yield of delicious pulp compared to bitter seeds is pretty small. So if you want muscadine grapes, you probably should look into growing some of the cultivated varieties. They have all that wonderful flavor, but you get a lot more pulp and juice and fewer smaller seeds. People have been cultivating muscadine grapes in eastern North Carolina for a long time. There's a vine in Manteo, North Carolina, that is estimated to be 400 years old. Muscadine vines get large and heavy, so if you're going to grow them, you need a really sturdy trellis. You want to space your vines about 10 feet apart and recognize that it will take 3, maybe 4 years before they're yielding grapes. And the grapes, well, they're not going to grow in bunches like the white and red grapes you buy in the grocery store. They actually grow seemingly individually, but it's often actually large, loose clusters. When they're ripe, the muscadines have a wonderful fragrance, and they will lift easily from the stem. If you have to pull them hard, well, they're not ripe. And even ripe muscadine grapes have a thick skin, not like you're used to in bunch grapes. The skin has a little bit of a bitter flavor, but I personally like it. A lot of people don't. The way to eat a muscadine to avoid the skin is to simply squeeze the ripe grape directly into your mouth. But your work isn't done as you taste that wonderful juice. You're going to have to use your tongue and your teeth to sort the seeds from the pulp. It's not that difficult. It's really worth the effort to eat wonderful muscadines in eastern North Carolina this time of year. And if you want to grow grapes, well, it's the only kind that's really going to do well for you. You might get your grapevines to grow beautifully and yield bunch grapes for a little while, but it's usually short-lived. Go out and find some muscadines, whether in the wild, maybe even in a farmer's market. And once you find one that you really enjoy, plant a vine yourself, and you'll be enjoying it, well, for years to come. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
The Downeast Journal is made possible by our Public Radio East members in partnership with CCHC Newbern Cancer Care, national innovative treatments administered locally. Located at 1010 Medical Park Avenue off Wellens Boulevard. CCHC Newbern Cancer Care, online at cchealthcare.com. The third annual Party in Pink Zumbathon is happening Saturday, September 6th at the Rivertown Ballroom in downtown Newbern. The proceeds from the event go to the Susan G. Komen Foundation. Michael Peterson talks with coordinator and Zumba instructor for the event, Kimberly Anderson.
You are hosting a Zumbathon to raise money for the Susan G. Komen Foundation, a nonprofit that contributes to breast cancer research, outreach, and advocacy. How did you decide to give this organization the money?
Well, 100% of what we raise goes to Zumba, and they donate it to Susan G. Komen. It's actually an annual campaign that Zumba does to raise money for breast cancer research. We're hoping to raise at least $1,500.
For those people who are interested in participating in the Zumbathon event, what should they bring with them?
I would suggest they wear comfortable workout clothes, bring some water and a towel.
Zumba is a lot like dancing, so it definitely requires physical activity, burning anywhere from 350 to 650 calories an hour. We know it's good exercise, but what are some of the other benefits of Zumba?
Well, besides being a total body workout, you know, toning all the major muscles of the body, it also is a great cardio workout. So it tones and strengthens the heart and the lungs. You get great stress relief, and it can even help fight depression.
Why do you think Zumba has grown so much in popularity?
Well, it's because every class feels like a party. You just lose yourself in the music, and the time passes so quickly, and before you know it, class is over, you're dripping with sweat, and you just feel exhilarated.
How can folks get more information?
They can email me at zumba@suddenlink.net.
That was Public Radio East's Michael Peterson speaking with coordinator and Zumba instructor Kimberly Anderson. We leave you now with the headliner for this weekend's Where Rivers Meet Summer Jazz Festival, Gregory Porter. Here's Liquid Spirit.
Unreroute the rivers, let the damned water beat. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, let the liquid spirit free. The folk are thirsty because of man's unnatural hand. Watch what happens when the people catch wind of the water hidden banks of hard, dry land. Clap your hands now. Clap your hands now. Go ahead and clap your hands now. Clap your hands now. Dip down and take a drink and fill your water tank. Dip down, take a drink and fill your water tank. Liquid spirit. Liquid spirit. Liquid spirit. Liquid spirit. Clap your hands now.